Chapter 20. Curtin and Dobbs were not in good humor. The pass across the highest mountain range was still far off, and the trail leading to this high pass had become so difficult that the two partners became near senseless from desperation. They no longer spoke to each other in the usual manner. They bellowed at each other, howled like wild beasts, and cursed themselves and the rest of the world for the hard job they had undertaken. And most bitterly of all, they cursed the absent Howard. While they had to drive his burros, to load and unload his packs, and to take care of all his belongings, he was most probably now enjoying himself, with a pretty Indian hussy sitting on his knees, and another brown wench hanging on his neck, and before him a swell meal of roast turkey and a bottle of tequila. And here, his two partners had to slave for him and die for him on that goddamn hell of a funking trail, put there by the Lord for no other reason than to make you suffer for all the dirty sins 50 generations of your forefathers committed. Why the hell did we offer to take along the packs of that son of a skunk? As if he couldn't take them by himself, or with the help of those goddamn Indians who, of all the people in the world, had to come to get that goddamn boy of theirs out of hell, where he was already being well cared for, and where he properly belonged.
And isn't it always his burros that, goddammit, won't march in line and stray off and smash their packs against the trees, trying to get them off their funkin' backs?
He knew that goddamn storyteller did, why he wanted us to take along his packs. They are the heaviest of all, and the most carelessly packed. God knows his burros are the laziest that were ever born anywhere under heaven, and the most stubborn. Hell, how I wish they would break off the trail and drop down the 3,000 feet of the gorge and crash their bones! Why would I care? Tail with him and all he has. It was lucky for them that heaven was too high above to hear them, and lay 50 broken trees across the trail, and soaked the narrow path with so much water that the burros would sink into the mud up to the saddles, so that for once they would learn what a really tough trail on the Sierra Madre is like when hell and heaven are against the traveler. What they encountered was in fact nothing, if you would ask a hard-boiled arriero, whose business it is to bring pack trains of mules across the Sierra Madre at any time of year. Of course, it would have meant much to have one more man at hand on trails like this one. A pack which has come off the animal's back can only be properly replaced by two men, and while these two are loading, another man is needed to look after the rest of the pack burros, so that they will not break loose and stray off and enter dead trails. No sooner did the two realize that it was ridiculous to curse the old man than they started quarreling and yelling and shouting at each other. The burros did not mind, because they had more sense, and besides, had been raised on a better philosophical system. All of a sudden, Dobbs halted, wiped the sweat from his face with an angry gesture, and said, "I stop here for the night. If you want to go on, it's okay by me. Only leave my packs and my burros here. I'm no goddamn never slave. Get me?"
"It's only 3 o'clock. We might make 4 miles more."
Curtin saw no reason for camping so early. "No one has ordered you to camp here. If you want to march 20 miles more, what the hell do I care?" Dobbs stood before Curtin as if he were ready to spring at him.
"Ordered? You?"
Curtin asked.
"You don't mean to say you're the boss of this outfit?"
"Perhaps you are. Just say it. I'm waiting." Dobbs' face became redder.
"All right, if he can't do any more."
"Can't do any more? What do you mean by that crack?" Dobbs seemed to go mad. "Don't make me laugh. I can do 4 times as much as a mug like you, and kick 6 of your size both sides of your pants. Can't do any more. And how is your grandmother?" "It's simple. I don't want any more, if you must know, mug."
"What's the good of hollering?"
Curtin stayed calm enough.
"We've started. Now we have to stick it out, like it or not. All right, then, let's camp here."
"That's what I said long ago. Here is water. Very good water. It's a good place for camping, isn't it?"
"Right you are. Not likely we'll find any water during the next 3 hours."
"So what's the arguing about?" Dobbs began to unload the burro standing next to him. Curtin came close and gave him a hand at the job. The burros unloaded, quarreling, started again. Who was to cook? Who was to look for fuel? And who was to care for the burros? Who repaired the pack saddles? There had never been any disputing about these jobs as long as Howard had been with them. Now it seemed as if they had lost the capacity for sound and simple reasoning. They were overtired, their nerves quivering like telegraph wires in the open country. They couldn't agree any longer on who had to do this job and who that. When the meal was finally cooked and ready, Curtin found that he had done most of the work, 3 times his share. He didn't mind and said nothing. He put up with Dobb's bad humor. Something during the march today, the climate, the growing altitude, a fall, the hot sun, a sting from a reptile, a bite of an insect, a scratch of a poisonous thorn, whatever it was, must, so it appeared to Curtin, be responsible for Dobb's strange behavior. Eating usually conciliates people. So also here in the loneliness of the Sierra, the meal Curtin and Dobbs had together softened their feelings toward each other. It calmed their nerves. They came to speak with less yelling, and with more sense than they had done during the last 6 hours.
"Wonder what the old man is doing now,"
Curtin said. "I'm sure he's having a swell time with those Indians," Dobbs replied. "His meal will be better than ours, sure." At mention of the old man, Dobbs looked casually at Howard's packs, which lay close to where Dobbs was sitting and filling his pipe. For a minute his looks were fixed on these packs, and in his mind he tried to figure out how much they might be worth in dollars and cents. Curtin misjudged Dobbs' expression, for he said,
"Oh, I think we can manage his packs all right. This is the first day we had to handle everything without his help. Tomorrow it'll be lots easier, once we get the real go of it and are used to being one hand short."
"How far from the railroad do you think we are now?" Dobbs asked.
"As the crow flies, it wouldn't be so far. Since we aren't crows, it'll take us quite some time. Days, perhaps a week more. These mountain trails make the way 10 times longer, winding round and round and going up and down as if they'd never end. And in the evening, if you look behind, it seems as if you can almost spit in the place you left in the morning. The worst isn't over yet. One of the guys we met near the village told me we'll have stretches where we'll hardly make 6 miles during the whole day, loading and unloading a dozen times while the animals can't take the steep ravines. I figure we can make the high pass in 2 days more, then 3 or 4 days more to go before we actually reach the railroad. But it may be more still. Any sort of difficulties may come our way any time."
To this, Dobbs said nothing. He stared into the fire. Then he filled his pipe once more and lighted it. It was as though he could not take his eyes off the packs. His glance wandered from the fire to them and back again very often. Yet Curtin took no notice of it. Unexpectedly, Dobbs pushed Curtin in the ribs and laughed in a curious way. Curtin felt uneasy. Something was wrong with Dobbs. He was not himself any longer. To cover his growing anxiety, Curtin tried to laugh, his eyes resting on Dobbs' face. As if keyed up by Curtin's nervous laugh, Dobbs broke out into bellowing laughter, which made him almost lose his breath. Curtin became still more confused. He did not know what to make of it.
"What's the joke? Won't you let me in on it, Dobby?"
"In on it? I should say I will." He roared with laughter and had to hold his belly.
"Well, spill it."
"Oh, Sonny, my boy." "Isn't that too funny for words?" He had to stop for breath, for his laughter became hysterical.
"What's so funny?"
Curtin's face was turning gray with anxiety. Dobbs acted no longer sane. Dobbs said, "This old jackass of a bonehead mug hands over all his pay to us and lets us go off with it just like that." He snapped his fingers.
"I don't quite understand."
"But man, can't you see? It's all ours now. We drag it off, and where can he look for us? We don't go back to the port at all, sabe? We go straight up north and leave that ass flat. Let him marry an Indian hussy. What do we care?" Curtin was now all seriousness.
"I simply can't get you, Dobby. What the hell are you talking about? You must be dreaming."
"Oh, don't be such a sap. Where did you grow up? Under the canvas of a revival show or what? Well, to make it plain to a dumbhead like you, we take the load and go off. What is there so very special about that? Nothing new to you, I should say."
"I begin to see through it now."
"Long distance, was it?" Dobbs giggled. Curtin rose. He moved around as if to get his bearings. He could not believe his ears. There must be something wrong. He came back to the fire, but did not squat down. He looked around, gazed up at the clear sky, and then said,
"Now get this straight, Dobby. If you mean to lift the goods off the old man, count me out. And what's more, I won't let you do it."
"And who else? Just come and tell Pop."
As I said, as long as I'm around and on my feet, you won't take a single grain from the old man's pay. I think I've made myself pretty clear enough, or have I?
Dobbs grinned. Yes, you have, sweetie. Sure you have. I can see very plainly what you mean. You want to take it all for yourself and cut me off. That's the meaning.
No, that's not the meaning. I'm on the level with the old man, exactly as I'd be on the level with you if you weren't here.
Taking up his pouch, Dobbs filled another pipe. Maybe I don't need you at all. I can take it alone. I don't need no outside help, buddy. He laughed while lighting his pipe. Curtin, still standing, looked Dobbs over from head to foot.
I signed that receipt.
So did I. What of it? I've signed many receipts in my life.
Doubtless. I've signed lots of things, too, which I forgot about as soon as the ink was dry. This case, I think, is different. The old man hasn't stolen the goods. There is honestly earned property. That we know all too well. He didn't get that money by lousy, cowardly stick-up or from the races or by blackmailing or by the help of loaded bones. He's worked like a slave, the old man has. And for him, old as he is, it was a harder task than for us, believe me. I may not respect many things in life, but I do respect most sincerely the money somebody's worked and slaved for honestly. And that's on the level.
Hell can take your Bolshevik ideas. A soapbox always makes me sick. And to have to hear it even out here in the wilderness is the goddamn limit.
No Bolshevik ideas at all, and you know that. Perhaps it's the aim of the Bolsheviks to see that a worker gets the full value of what he produces and that no one tries to cheat a worker out of what's honestly coming to him. Anyway, put that out of the discussion. It's none of my business. And Bolshevik or no Bolshevik, get this straight, partner. I'm on the level. And as long as I'm around, you don't even touch the inside of the old man's packs. That's it, and it's final.
Having said this, Curtin squatted down by the fire, took out his pipe, filled it, and puffed lustily. He soon looked as if he had forgotten the whole affair, as if it had been only another of the many silly talks they had had during the long months, when there was never anything new to talk about, and they talked only for the sake of talking. Dobbs watched him for many minutes. Then he chuckled. You are a fine guy. I've always had my suspicions about you. Now I know that I've been right, brother. You can't befuddle me. Not me, smarty.
What suspicions are you talking about?
Easy, my boy. Hold it. Get this and weep. You can't hide anything from me, brother. I know that for some time you've had it in mind to bump me off at your earliest convenience and bury me somewhere out here in the bush like a dog so that you can make off not only with the old man's stuff but with mine into the bargain. Then having reached the port safely, you'll laugh like the devil to think how dumb the old man and I were not to have seen through your hellish schemes. I've known for a long time what was brewing. I'm wise to you, honey. The pipe dropped out of Curtin's fingers. His eyes had widened as Dobbs talked. He couldn't think straight. His head ached, and he felt dizzy in a strange way. When, after a while, he succeeded in getting command of his thoughts again, he saw for the first time a great opportunity to enrich himself, as Dobbs had suggested. This struck him as alien, because never before had he had any idea of the kind. He was in no way scrupulous in life. Far from being that, he could take without remorse anything that was easy to pick up. He knew how the big oil magnates, the big financiers, the presidents of great corporations, and in particular the politicians, stole and robbed wherever there was an opportunity. Why should he, the little feller, the ordinary citizen, be honest if the big ones knew no scruples and no honesty, either in their business or in the affairs of the nation? And these great robbers, sitting in easy chairs before huge mahogany tables, and those highwaymen, speaking from the platforms of the conventions of the ruling parties, were the same people who in success stories and in the papers were praised as valuable citizens, the builders of the nation, the staunch upholders of our civilization and of our culture. What were decency and honesty, after all? Everybody around him had a different opinion of what they meant. Yet, whatever angle he looked at the accusation Dobbs had made against him, he found it the dirtiest he could think of. There was no excuse for such a thing as Dobbs had proposed. This brought him a new thought. If Dobbs could accuse his partner of such intentions, it was proof of Dobbs' shabby character, now revealed in full for the first time. If Dobbs had such thoughts, then Curtin must look out for his own safety. Dobbs would not hesitate to try to get for himself all that he accused Curtin of trying to get. Curtin could now see that in the future he would have to fight constantly, not only for his property, but for his very life. Realization of this dulled Curtin's eyes as he stared at the fire. He saw danger lurking, and he knew he could not elude it. He was helpless, Curtin was. He had no means of protecting himself against Dobbs. For 4 or 5, perhaps even 6 or 7 days, they would still be alone together here in the mountains, wild, desolate, and forsaken as few other mountain regions in the world are. The two men might meet somebody on the trails, but that would not mean security for Curtin. For a few pesos, Dobbs could easily persuade anyone to take his side. If they met no one, so much the better for Dobbs. Curtin might pass one night on guard against Dobbs, but during the night he would surely fall asleep, and sleep harder than ever. Then Dobbs would not even need to waste a bullet on him. He could bind him tight or knock him cold, and then dig him in. He need not even trouble to crush his head. He could just bury him alive if he wished. There was only one way out of this danger. Curtin had to do to Dobbs what Dobbs had in mind against Curtin. There was no other way of escape.
I don't want to have his dirt,
Curtin thought.
His dirt may rot in the bush for all I care. My life is worth just as much to me as his is to him.
He looked for his pipe, which he had dropped on the ground. His right hand rested on his right knee as he bent down to pick up his pipe. With a slow gesture, he moved his right hand toward his body and let it slide toward his hip. But before his hand reached the holster, Dobbs had his own gun out. Another move, brother, and I pull the trig. Curtin kept his hands where they were. Stick 'em up!
Up! Up!
Dobbs shouted. Curtin raised his hands to his head. Higher, please, or I'll pluck you off like a shot from hell. Dobbs smiled, satisfied, and nodded his head.
Was I right or was I? Didn't judge you right, son of a stinking dog. Talking big, huh? Talking Bolshevik Sunday school. You can't smoke me, brother, with sweet love songs. Nope, not me. Protecting other people's goods. You?
Dobbs changed his tone and yelled,
Stand up, you skunk, and take it like a man.
Curtin rose slowly to his feet and, with his hands still up in the air, turned round. Dobbs reached for Curtin's gun, and as Dobbs grabbed the gun, his own gun went off because he had the trigger rather loose. For a fraction of a second, Dobbs was surprised, and Curtin, feeling by instinct that Dobbs was off his guard for a quarter of a second, jerked about and landed Dobbs a good hook on the jaw, knocking him to the ground. He threw himself upon Dobbs quickly and disarmed him. Then he sprang up and stepped a few paces back with two guns pointed at the rising Dobbs.
Cards are now dealt the other way, Dobby,
Curtin said and laughed. So I see. Dobbs was on his feet. He knew Curtin would not shoot him when he had no gun in his hand. It gave him a curious taste in his mouth to realize that Curtin would play fair, whereas he knew that he himself would not give the other a chance. He wanted to win, no matter how. To admit, even to himself, that Curtin had nobler feelings than he only made Dobbs hate him the more.
Now look here, Dobby,
Curtin said in a calm and conciliating voice.
You're all wrong. Not for a moment did I ever mean to rob you or to harm you. I would fight for you and your stuff just as I shall for the old man.
Yes, I know. Fine. If you really mean what you say, then hand over my cannon. Curtin laughed out loud.
I better not. Little boys shouldn't play with matches and scissors. Mother spank.
I understand, Dobbs said shortly. He went over to the fire and squatted down. Curtin emptied Dobbs' gun, weighed it in his hand, threw it up in the air, and caught it, cowboy fashion, and then held it toward Dobbs, hesitated for a second, looked Dobbs in the face, and then put the gun in his own pocket on his left hip. He squatted down by the fire, taking care not to get too close to Dobbs. He took out his pipe, filled, and lighted it. After he had taken a few puffs, he looked at his pipe as though examining it and said in a casual way,
And that was another day.
Curtin knew he was not any better off than half an hour before. He could not watch Dobbs day and night for the next 5 or 6 days. He would fall asleep sooner or later, and Dobbs would get the better of him. Dobbs would show no mercy, now less than before. Only one of them could survive this trip. He who fell asleep would be the victim of him who kept awake. There would come a night when one of the two would kill the other for no other reason than to gain one night of sleep.
Wouldn't it be better, under these circumstances?
Curtin finally began.
Yes, as I said, wouldn't it be better, the way it stands, to separate tomorrow or right now, this very night? I earnestly believe that would be the best way of solving this tough problem.
Of course it would be the best. I see the whole thing. It would suit you fine.
What suit me more than you?
Curtin asked, rather perplexed, so that you could fall on me from behind, stab me or shoot me in the back, or perhaps tip off bandits and send them after me. You're a great pal. My pal. Shit.
If you think that, then I can't see any way out of this fix we're in.
Curtin shrugged.
There seems nothing to do but tie you up every night and during the daytime, too.
Yes, agreed upon. I think you must, brother of mine. Dobbs sneered and stretched his arms as if to show his strength. Come on, you lousy yellow skunk. Come on, tie me up. I'm waiting. Waiting, I say. Hear me? Curtin realized that it would not be easy to tie up Dobbs. He realized also that the only chance he had to overpower Dobbs was now, and that his chance most likely would never come again. But he was afraid to take what he knew was the only road to save himself. In situations like this, Dobbs was the stronger, because he would act upon his impulse and think afterwards.